Succession number 22084, Reel 2.
Where did your sort of patriotic feeling lie?
Oh, obviously for England.
Why?
Why? Because my grandparents were English, British. My mother was English. My father had so much England running through his veins that, as I mentioned, he would always call England home. And when he was going to England, visiting, so I'm going home. I'd say, but this is your home. So there was a... We were an extension of England to a very large extent, very much so. And Dad was extremely patriotic, as I've indicated. And I did find a funny thing going away, that particularly when we were when I was taken prisoner, and they would ask what nationality, and we, my other fellows and I, would say Australian. No, English. We'd say, what's your nationality? British. But you're not British. Yes, we're British. You're Australian. No, we're British. How can you be British? The Indians say they're British. The New Zealanders say they're British. The Australians say they're British. How can you all be British? I thought that was quite humorous. Next question.
There was that period of the sort of phony war where not a lot happened. It didn't appear to be happening terribly fast. What was the feeling then at that particular time, before Dunkirk was to fall in May of 40? What was the feeling about the war at that point?
It was remote. It was there. It was some sort of a threat, but it didn't appear to be a very serious threat in that it was such a long way away. I guess it was felt that we would be sending, well, we were sending troops over there. It was expected to finish earlier, not escalate. In that, as you term, phony war, it was a lull, something of the calm before the storm, as it were. And I felt we all felt pretty complacent, and we all got on with our army training, and there's no great rush about anything, and society slowly adjusted to a changing tempo with no great fear of... And Australia was so isolated, and we had Singapore protected by the British, and we had the British Navy, and this was a war going over there in Europe like the one before, and we'd send troops and we'd win the war and so on. I guess that was the general feeling, uninformed feeling about.
When you joined, what was the process? What actually happened when you joined up?
The AIF? Oh, not a very difficult one. I just went to the Karakata Barracks here, recruiting centre. I'd put in my application the next day, of course. I was called up on the 22nd. And by this time, my age was 20. Well, to them, it was 20. So it was just a matter of going in, answering the usual questions, having the medical test. But of course, because I'd had these things and was a soldier, I think they sort of took a look at me and saw that I was reasonably healthy and so on. And there were no great dramas about it. I just went through the normal procedure pretty rapidly. And went in and had a uniform in my old uniform, and they threw a new one at me. So I had to break in another pair of army boots. And then we were there. That was easy. It was interesting because I was so accustomed to army life with messes and queuing for messes and this and that and so on, and the army procedure, that I wasn't hassled by it. We were confined to barracks. No one was allowed leave at the time. But there was a hole in the fence that we all knew about, and those wanting to go out could duck through the hole. And, of course, being very familiar, my first home was in Claremont, my second one was in My family home was in Dalkeith, but it was originally called Claremont, so the area was very familiar to me anyway. And the transferring from one to the other was just a piece of cake.
Do you recall what you had to sign, if anything?
No. I think we had to sign a pledge to king and country and the flag and that sort of stuff. I think that's the only thing, really. And I think by joining the AIF, we automatically gave them the right to send us overseas. And I can't recall anything else. Mm. Have you found other people have to sign important things?
I was interested to find out whether you knew exactly what you were letting yourself in for in regard joining up, how long you promised to serve.
I don't think that was a considered option. And I think at the time I would have signed anything. You know, if they said you're in for 10 years or 5 years, I'd have thought to myself, well, if that's the deal, that's the deal. And so,
did you know, for instance, what you might get paid?
We had a pretty fair, five bob a day.
Does that seem like a good deal to you?
Well, that's what you're being paid. You know, it wasn't sort of an option. I have an interesting little story here which could probably be edited out, but to me it's one of these little humorous things. That in the AIF, I also was sent to as a corporal, sent to a potential officer school with two other corporals. And we all came out as sergeants, and I was made sergeant of 12 platoon. And a few months after that, I was made acting company sergeant major, which is a big rise from a clerk to a company sergeant major in the space of a few months. But I had read How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And there was a very interesting little article there of how a top American magnate got all his people together and got them to... you can cut this out, I think. You don't want to hear it.
No, keep going.
How you get on, increase... there was a lot of conflict between the workers and management. So on a blackboard, he drew a line down and he said, now, what do you expect of management? And he wrote down, as they said, we expect more pay, less hours, etc., etc. He wrote all these things down and said, well, if management saw fit to give you these things, what could they expect from you? And they said, more attention to detail, more thoroughness, and so on and so on. So he said, well, if you stick to your bargain, we'll stick to our side of the bargain. They did, and the business prospered. Well, I was going through the hut on one occasion at night. In those days, in my own experience, I used to listen to people's complaints, and they were always gristles. Nevertheless, I was squatting down with them, they were sitting on their palliasses, and they were talking about how bad things were, all these sort of stupid complaints about the food and this, that and the other. Because it must be remembered that at that time, a lot of the recruits came from government recruiting tours. They'd send trains up to out into the country to the even the more remote mining areas, and they would encourage people to join the army, and they'd be down to Fremantle Wharf and so on. And so when we were formed, there was a very great mixture of people, and I had a great mixture in my platoon and in my company. The age varied from the youngest, me at 18, to fellows well into their 40s, and I think we even had one in his 50s. And a great number of them were miners, and more were from Fremantle Wharves, wharfies. And they all were good blokes. And once over the next few years, I had a chance to get to know them extremely well. But you can understand from their point of view, a war was on, they wanted to do their bit, or for whatever reason they joined the army. They wanted to get out there and fight, but they really didn't want to learn all the stuff like slaving arms and forming force or whatever, and all the parade ground stuff, and they certainly didn't like being told what to do. And it didn't help that the fellow telling them what to do looked about 16 and wanted to make Grenadier Guardsmen of them. There was a decided conflict of interest there, but we worked it out. That was one of the great challenges. We worked it out. But on this occasion, going through the hut and sitting down, listening to their gripes that the food was lousy and being told what to do and so on. So on my mental blackboard, with the line down the centre, I recorded these things. So then I said, well, if it were possible for the officers and NCOs to fulfil your requirements, what should they expect from you? And they said, bugger all, we're only five bob a day bloody privates. I just wondered what Dale Carnegie would have done about that.
Some people were calling you five bob a day murderers. Were you aware of that at the time?
Yes, but it didn't really have much influence on us, because as far as we were concerned, I guess there was a job to be done. We knew that to protect our country and protect Britain and so on, you have to go out there and be prepared to kill and be killed. And this is, I think, one of the tragedies of war and armies and so on. That, in a sense, they're right, that we train people to be murderers. You know, the old song that put a rifle in his hand and sent him away to murder people, and that's correct. And there is something quite ridiculous that in this society, in any society, you train people to murder others. But as yet, I still don't know, until the politicians learn to have better dialogues, that we can do anything else. If somebody wants to take your piece of land and you've got to use force to get him away, well, you've got to try and use force. But I suppose then, I don't know whether I personally thought too deeply about it.
To what degree were you looking for adventure?
Oh, considerably. Considerably. I've been thinking just recently about that, because I felt this could come up. I would say adventure was an enormous part of it. You know, it's because at that age, late teens, early 20s, which I suppose majority of soldiers seem to be, service people, you've got a lot of adrenaline coming. You don't know fear. You have this feeling that you're going to live forever and so on.
What about the thoughts of those people that were or weren't in? You had to be in it. To what degree was there sort of pressure?
Yes, well, there was some, but this was still in 40. This was still fairly early in the war. And I remember, we haven't got to it, but from January 41 I was away and away for the rest of the war. And earlier in the war there wasn't quite the same pressure, but I know that we had something, the fact that we were RAF and going away, we did have an elitist attitude, particularly to the militia, whom we call chocolate soldiers, and to the Air Force, whom we call Blue Orchids. After all, we were frontline troops. We were going there to get into the action, and they were going to stay up there in the sky or stay here and defend Australia or whatever. Yes, there's a lot of ego and, you know, youthful adventure and all that sort of. I think it takes a lot of years to form a much truer perspective of reality.
Tell us about what was involved in the training, what you were being told of preparing for your experience.
Actually, that's a very good question, John, because all our training was based on World War I. All the training that I'd had through the cadets, the militia, into the RAF. The training in the RAF, in fact, wasn't all that good because nobody knew much about it. The officers had all been trained on World War I tactics and so on. And so we learned how to attack an extended line, how to seek cover, how to do army training, and particularly for European countrysides. Quite different from the desert that we found ourselves in, quite different. But we learnt how to march and how to form ourselves as a body of men, how to live out and live rough. There's a whole lot we didn't learn that, that we realised later when we were in action. Going to come through?
That's fine.
Okay. So there's a lot thinking about it, if we were to go back into the same situation, we'd have a lot more, it'd be a different war for a start, so I suppose even that thought is invalid.
And you mentioned that there was this ego and confidence. To what degree did you feel as though you were being, really prepared? With this equipment, with this training?
Well, I suppose every man had his own thoughts, and I certainly can't speak for the entire Australian Army. I can't remember thinking about it too deeply at all. I think it was more a case of just accepting the situation as it was and going along with it. The old saying, ours not to reason why, ours just to do and die, and I think that would be about the extent of it. We realised we could lose our lives, but you think you've got a pretty good chance of not losing your life.
Well, that, I was going to ask that question possibly a little later on. You're just doing, following orders, going where you're told.
Yeah.
What then of, the approaching departure? What did you know of where you were going to go and the situation at the war at the time?
Well, there was confusion there as well, in that initially we were given a colour patch which was to have been the 8th Division colour patch. And it was the thought circulated that we would be going up to Singapore. Then with Dunkirk and what happened over there, and the Allies, Britain, had to change its war plan, and the desert became a focal point with Italy now in the war. So, as you might remember, the 9th Division was put together from a lot of troops that were in England and added to by a number of troops that came from Australia. So the shape of our colour patch was changed, our division was changed, and we were sent to the Middle East instead of Singapore. Mm.
But did you understand that what was going on at this time?
Well, to a degree. We sort of were sufficiently familiar, aware of what was happening in Europe and Mussolini coming in and the thought that he could sort of swing down and the importance of the Middle East. Not that any of us probably knew too much about the Middle East anyway, but it just also seemed an exciting thing to do.
Well, you were mentioning earlier that there was this sort of confidence about going away, about being involved. With the fall of France and Dunkirk in late May of 40, what were the feelings then about your situation and what you might be expecting in the future?
Fortunately, John, they weren't very informed thoughts, no ones of great concern. We were going out there and by God we're going to win. We didn't sort of line all the odds up. Well, and I think I speak for a lot of the fellows there. I'm not speaking for a lot of the more informed officers and, the older people who thought deeply and more awarely of the situation. But I can't recall it worrying me that we were sort of going up there. But we'll get on to a little bit of that later once we get into the Tobruk scene. That then it changes its colour a little. At least the colour of my being able to speak for other people also.
Well, tell us what was involved in preparing to go away and the thoughts for leaving.
Well, that's interesting too, in that I was sent over to another OCTU in Liverpool in Sydney. I'd only been there 5 days and I was recalled because the battalion was on pre-embarkation leave. And then, so I went straight on leave, and then we sort of packed up and virtually went off. Within, say, a fortnight, the whole thing. I suppose there was just amongst us, or then we could only speak from himself, there was excitement, you know, the thought of going overseas. Also, it's something a little bit different. At that time, having been sergeant and then company sergeant major, you don't spend, it's not like, say, a private in the line mixing with the fellows in the tents and so on. As a CSM, I had my own separate room and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And you're in the office, in the sergeant's mess, and when you go there, well, you're not really talking about the dynamics of the war, you're talking about, you know, having another beer and so on. In retrospect, I don't think we were a terribly profound group of people. You know, I don't think we let the major picture, the big picture, disturb our smaller thoughts.
Well, what was involved with, you know, being an officer and getting your rank?
Well, I didn't get a commission, but because of the situations. It involved a lot of responsibility. For example, as a sergeant, my platoon commander, a lovely bloke, who'd been running a very good hotel here, had very little experience. My company commander happened to be a schoolmaster who had got his commission fairly quickly in the 16th Battalion, Cavan Highlands. They had really no experience. My platoon commander was sent to be treasurer of the officer's mess, so he was removed from the training. So I was only thinking about it. You got me thinking about a few of these things. That I really, of 12 platoon, I was pretty well responsible for the training of them. You might say, well, hell, how much did you know? And that's a good, very good question. In broader terms, not much. But I still knew a hell of a lot more than they did, you know, about a whole range of things.
Some of the older chaps in the group, had they had experience in the First World War, some of them?
Not too many. A couple of them had, yes.
How were they seen by the rest?
Pretty ancient.
And you're mentioning people in their 40s and one or two in their 50s.
Right.
How were they seen? How were they considered by the rest?
Well, I didn't discuss it with the others, and as a sort of, and I was 18 until well into Tobruk. I didn't engage them in conversation. I kept myself a bit remote and apart, and I just felt the way it had to be. I think it was more the traditional way anyway in the old army days. You know, it's that's why they had sergeants' messes and officers' messes and so on. They didn't mix it with the rank and file, as you might say, or say the Russian army would, or something like that. So therefore, one's thinking also is a little bit isolated in that regard. And whilst I would have done very well, in hindsight, to have certain situations, to have got one or two of these older people with the good heads and discussed it with them, I don't suppose my ego or position would permit me to do it. I couldn't get around. I felt once or twice this wouldn't be a bad idea, but I just couldn't get around to doing it. I just had to work it out myself. So, the way that went.
Were you in contact with your family prior to going away?
Oh, yes, because we still had sort of a certain amount of leave, and Northern was only 60 miles away. And we just lived exactly on the other side of the river here where we are. And the phones were there, and oh, yes. Yeah.
What were the general thoughts of your family toward you ultimately heading off?
They didn't discuss it with me. But knowing that my father is a pretty sentimental sort of person, and my mother would have kept things pretty much herself. You know, she wasn't one to remonstrate against Dad's wishes or and I think they just sort of went along with it. That's it. My older brother had been in the Navy in Melbourne, at least in the Naval Reserve. He was getting training over there, in business training, and he was called up a few days before the outbreak of war, and put straight onto a ship, and they were off, and he was in the scrap iron flotilla. So they were already accustomed to one son going off to war. And because I'd been so involved in the army and so on, they just seemed to expect it. Although Dad was very hurt when the mother of an old friend of mine, schoolboy friend, stopped down the street and called him a murderer. "You're a murderer. You are a murderer, sending your son away to war." Dad was very hurt over that, very hurt. So I think he felt bad enough about it as it was, about having that. So after our training, on the 3rd of January, 41, we went to Fremantle and loaded aboard our ships.
Tell us about leaving to come to Fremantle. I presume you're talking coming from Northern to Fremantle.
No, we came down by train.
What was that experience like? You're finally heading off.
Part of the deal, yeah, I can't sort of remember being over the top about it, nor can I remember being too somber about it. I think it was sort of a blend of excitement and leaving home and so on. So you get these sort of emotions, and you don't really try and define them too deeply.
What was the atmosphere on the train, do you think, as it passed through the stations?
Yes, I suppose. I suppose 60 is a long time to quite remember. It wasn't quite the same as coming back home again. Although I do remember when I came back from the Octu, which only lasted 5 days, we were marching down the St. George's Terrace, and somebody had jumped in and got my CSM position. Perhaps they moved me aside so an older man could get it, I don't know. But anyway, that's what happened, and so I was back at this time to being platoon commander of 12th Platoon. And Dad was, as we were marching through the street, saw me, and I was calling out, keeping the platoon in step. And he ran alongside all the way down to the station, all the way, to say goodbye. Yeah, he was a great dad. So then we got down to Fremantle on the boat. We were put on the Aquitania, and that was quite a good experience because it was a big ship, as you know, a four-funneled ship. And the officers were travelling first class. We were travelling, you might say, second class, but it was still pretty good because the ship hadn't been altered to troop ship conditions.
Before we get on board, what was it like on the wharf? What was the feeling like on the wharf?
Well, the whole thing melded itself into sort of one long memory, which is now way back there. Really, all these things happened with the measure of excitement and natural, I suppose, regret at leaving home. And I can't remember, but I would expect the same feelings of wonder, whether you'd come back, whether you'd see them all again. Those sort of thoughts that... will I see these come back here? Is this the last time I'll see them? What's going to happen to me? What's it going to be?
Was this really the first time these thoughts had entered your head?
That's a long question. Yeah, I mean, it's so long ago. No doubt I probably would have thought it. But like anything you do as a teenager, a young man, you feel pretty invulnerable. You don't feel death. You don't visualize it. what I did visualize, perhaps not then, but it's hard to know when the thoughts start, that I could get my face blown off or could get my testicles blown off. I suppose those are probably the two important things to a young man. You know, you could lose your sight or something like that. There's one thing I certainly didn't consider at all in any sense, and that's being a POW. That just wasn't in it.